NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
We are pro-Second Amendment. We're just pro-gun safety. We support, you know, background checks, red flag laws, banning certain assault weapons, really the things that actually endanger people.
Notice that there are a lot of folks who say they're pro-Second Amendment and then immediately list all of the things that are not pro-Second Amendment. Good Friday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. As Mother Jones noted online this afternoon, today is National Gun Violence Awareness Day, as declared by Michael Bloomberg's Everytown for Gun Safety. So there are a lot of gun control events taking place around the nation, including in Cincinnati, where you heard that young anti-gun activist talking about those quote-unquote common sense gun safety proposals that just used to be called gun control bills back before they realized how toxic the phrase gun control was. So the mayor of Cincinnati announced that the city is suing the state of Ohio over an issue that we've talked quite a bit about recently here on Cam and Company, the issue of firearms preemption law.
Increasingly, through the power of the NRA's influence, this democracy is being taken away.
Yeah, he says this democracy is being taken away because cities like Cincinnati can't take away the Second Amendment rights of their residents because Ohio state law says, you know what, we're going to leave this up to the state legislature. All gun-related legislation got to be up to the state legislature. Why is that? So that there can be one uniform standard. Now, again, we're still going to argue, frankly, about whether or not that standard is constitutional. But what it does do is it prevents this patchwork quilt of local laws and local ordinances that in many cases seem designed to trap and ensnare legal, lawful gun owners in the web of these local ordinances. And again, this is a big strategy on the part of gun control activists nationwide. Look what Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is doing, passing their own local gun control ordinances, getting sued, gladly getting sued. Their legal bills are being handled, and they're hoping to overturn Pennsylvania's firearms preemption law in court. Cincinnati now taking another step in that direction in another state. We've seen challenges to firearms preemption talked about in Des Moines, Iowa recently. So this is part and parcel of the broader agenda for anti-gun activists. Yes, they are very much looking for a sweeping semi-auto bans. Yes, they absolutely want, quote-unquote, universal background check laws. But they know that these firearm preemption laws make it harder for them to pass dozens of these local ordinances that would have to result in dozens of lawsuits to determine the constitutionality of them. The more of these local ordinances they can put on the books, the more of these local ordinances they believe will stand. And that benefits them. They also have pretty deep pockets. They can defend, dozens and dozens of lawsuits easier than gun owners can litigate dozens and dozens of lawsuits challenging these local firearm restrictions. So we're going to talk more about this later on in the program with our friend Sean Maloney from the Buckeye Firearms Association in Illinois. Moms Demand Action holding an event with several elected officials, including the state's attorney in Rockford, Illinois, talking about the state's red flag firearm laws. And I want you to listen to how the state's attorney actually explained people's rights able to be taken away without any sort of criminal activity whatsoever.
You don't have to commit a crime, so you're not under that umbrella of domestic violence and order protection, but it's a probable cause finding based upon a petition, you know, by the court that it's an emergency.
All right. So again, no crime committed. Just have to have probable cause by a court, and then your constitutional rights can be stripped from you. And by the way, you're not there at that hearing. Mm-hmm. This happens just outside of your view. And by the way, if there's determined that, again, there's probable cause that you're a danger to yourself or others, then your legally owned firearms are taken from you. And that's it. That's it. You don't get the mental health that you need. You don't get any sort of help or resources. You're left on your own with your sharp knives, with your car keys, maybe your cans of gasoline. Your legally owned firearms are taken from you. Everything else, prescription medication, all of that, all right there in your possession. This is not a mental health bill. This is a gun control bill. And interestingly enough, my state line in Illinois noted that in this county that we're just talking about, Winnebago County, where Rockford, Illinois is located, when this red flag law went into effect in January, we're now in early June, there have been zero petitions to the court in Winnebago County saying, hey, let's utilize this red flag firearm bill. So you're going to weaken constitutional rights. You're going to weaken due process rights. And again, as we've been talking about, this is a really ineffective tool to address the issue of individuals who are dangerous to themselves or others. Now, we're also continuing to follow the attack 1 week ago in Virginia Beach, Virginia, that left 12 people dead at the municipal building, one of the municipal buildings in the municipal complex. I saw a story today from WTOP, one of the Washington, D.C. radio stations, and this, to me, is really disturbing here. So we know that the police response initially a week ago was about 2 minutes to get to that municipal building number two. The police department is not very far away. But it took 36 minutes for the attacker in that case to be shot and killed by police. So what took so long? As it turns out, police were stymied gaining access into that building because of the electronic key cards that were there, again, to provide security for those inside. The attacker had an active key card because he was an employee. The police did not. And when they tried to breach the doors, they were fired upon, and it took, again, more than a half hour for law enforcement to be able to actively engage this individual. Now, they were, it sounds like, able to sort of pin him down. They were able to evacuate others from the building while officers were trying to gain entry. But again, you know, we just heard our governor here in Virginia call for a special session for all these new gun control laws, none of which would have actually prevented this attack. When we're talking about the things that we can do to save lives, I'll be honest with you. I think a lot of times we're not talking about legislation. We're talking about little things like ensuring that law enforcement can get access into these buildings to engage the attacker. So I want to welcome to the program right now a gentleman named Mike Matranga. He's the executive director of security and safety for the Texas City Independent School District, a former Secret Service agent. Mike, thank you so much for your time today, sir.
Thank you, Cam. I appreciate you having me today. It's an honor.
Absolutely, man. Listen, I really appreciate it because I know it's kind of a you're in kind of a unique situation right now. But I appreciate you making the time for us. And you know, again, when I read this story, you don't think about little things like things that are put in place to, again, to provide a layer of security can all of a sudden now become an impediment to those first responders who are trying to engage an attacker.
Right. And you know, my answer to that would be, you know, I took over as executive director of security for Texas City ISD in June of last year. And, you know, I told myself when I got here I was going to do what was right, not what was popular or politically correct. And, you know, I've stuck to my word on that. And we've come up with a very comprehensive plan. You know, in comparison with what happened in Virginia last week, we've gone to great lengths to secure our infrastructure, and we could get into other things. I said since day one that this is a puzzle, how we're going to solve this. But regarding the electronic locks and what I think could have happened just to mitigate that is, you know, being the executive director of the ISD at Texas City, it's my responsibility to brief and properly educate all of our local law enforcement responders on what functionality of the infrastructure security we have, how that works. It's also my responsibility to provide them access to our buildings as often as I can so that they can get a snapshot of how everything is laid out, what the composition of our building is. Is it drywall? Is it cinder block? How the electronic locks work? And you know, it has to start with a conversation. I think in the past, what districts or even municipalities have done is they've relied on police to do security work. And though I love my brothers and sisters in blue, sometimes policing is completely different than security. But it starts with a conversation between the two, me being the executive director and the chief or multiple chiefs in my jurisdiction. We have an understanding, or they have an understanding of what we need, how our systems work, and I supply them with what they need to access our buildings. You know, the proactive approach is what we use. We have a very reactive plan, and I'm also in favor of having multiple plans. Each building has their own obstacles that we have to overcome. You can't just have a simple plan for every single one. And so, you know, as frequently as this week, I've had one of our local jurisdiction SWAT teams reach out to me while I'm on this cruise and ask to use our buildings and our facilities on Monday when I get back, and I granted that. I know in the past that some districts or municipalities have been hesitant to do that. And so I think it can be done tastefully, and I think it can be done in a manner that's not too aggressive for the education environment.
Mm-hmm. Talking again with Mike Matranga from the Texas City Independent School District. And I want to go back to something that you said just a minute ago, Mike. You said that there's a difference between policing and security. And I think you're absolutely right about that. In fact, that's one of the conversations that we've had when it comes to armed school staff is you know, this idea that that some people have that, you know, teachers, they shouldn't be cops. Well, nobody's asking them to be cops. Nobody's asking them to go and arrest anybody. Nobody's asking them to, you know, perform all of the duties that a law enforcement officer would do. We're talking about them being able to serve, again, as a layer of security, that first response until law enforcement can arrive in those cases. Is that something that we need to be thinking more about, again, the difference between policing and security in some of these target areas?
I do. Yes, sir, I do. And I think that, you know, a lot of people are afraid to speak on this particular subject because they don't want to offend our brothers and sisters in blue. And they need to understand that I couldn't do my job without the local law enforcement jurisdictions that we have. We have four primary responding agencies in our immediate jurisdiction. And when I first got there, I've said since day one that, hey, because I took everything that I'm doing, based it off of kind of Santa Fe or Parkland, and I looked at it from, you know, a practical approach. If you can't respond to our incident within 12 minutes, you're a secondary responder. And that's hard to say to some people and some of our executives or our chiefs in law enforcement. Hey, sorry, we want your help, but if you can't be there within that 12-minute window, which we know is crucial, go to the rally point that we've designated prior to the event that we've already briefed you on. Wait for the deputies and the officers that are in the primary jurisdiction inside handling the situation. Wait for them to call for reinforcements. And I think that would cut back on a lot of chaos. You know, taking into consideration policing versus security, I look at things a little bit different than a patrolman would. Though we're all briefed on tactics and firearms and things as important as situational awareness, I think that, you know, if you have a security professional, we look at things just a little bit different. But like I said, there has to be a mutual respect. It has to start with a conversation. The conversation has to go to a plan, and then the plan has to be executed based upon the proper briefing and instructions that you've all agreed upon. And I would say, you know, the biggest issue is that guys, they have an issue with checking their ego. You know, I'm a team concept guy. We do everything as a team. You can go to our local jurisdictions, and I can guarantee you that they will probably tell you that we've all, none of them have gotten along as good as they currently do, because I include everyone within reason. You know, you have 200 officers show up to a scene and you haven't had a plan that designates who's in charge or who's responsible for what. You've got chaos. And so, like I said, in the beginning, I think that maybe some feelings were hurt initially when I got there. But like I said, I'm going to do what's right, not what's popular, and I'm not really worried about anybody's feelings at this point.
Mike Matranga, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Get back to your vacation. It's summer vacation for the Texas City Independent School District. Go enjoy yourself, and I hope we get a chance to talk again very soon, sir.
Cam, open invitation. Anytime you want to come down to Texas City, see what we're doing, open invitation. I would welcome it.
I would love to do that. Hope I can take you up on that at some point. Mike Matranga joins us, Executive Director of Security and Safety. They're in Texas City, Texas, for the Texas City Independent School District. So keeping on this subject, actually kind of turning our attention more to specifically school security. As I mentioned, today is Every Time for Gun Safety's big cultural gun control day. And so up in Maine, there were students at least at one high school in Portland at Deering High, who were walking out of class today. Not really walking out of class because it was a half day, but they're walking out after the half day, I guess, in support for some vaguely defined gun control laws. And again, the reason why is not because they intrinsically hate the Second Amendment or the right to keep and bear arms. The reason why is because they've been told to be afraid every time they go to school.
We just want stronger regulations and better safety precautions other than the general lockdown procedures that they already do on a yearly basis.
So, again, not a lot of specifics there, which is interesting because, you know, the gun control advocates say you should be afraid to go to school, but then they don't actually say, and here's specifically what needs to happen in order for you to feel safe going to school again, almost as if the gun control advocates, again, are more interested in using these students as part of their, you know, political process as opposed to actively trying to make these schools safer. But we do know, we just talked with Mike Matranga about some of the things that can be done to improve the safety of schools. As a matter of fact, in Texas, now this is a ways away from Maine, but Governor Greg Abbott has signed a bill we told you about last week, a bill that expands the Guardian program in Texas. So this is a program that allows for volunteers who are vetted and trained school staffers to carry, again, to serve as that first line of security, that first line of defense in school districts. A lot of rural school districts have adopted this program. So until now, there's been a cap of one guardian per 200 students. Now that cap has been removed, and you can basically the school district has a lot more leeway in terms of what they want and what they need. So if they decide, you know what, we want to have a guardian for every 50 students, they now have the ability to do so. I think this is good, providing, again, that flexibility for local school districts. Look, I'm not in favor of localities around the country being able to pass their own gun control laws because, again, we're talking about an individual right here, and it's not up to any layer of government to violate that individual right, whether it's federal, state, or local governments. But this isn't a Second Amendment issue. This is a security issue. And there are not going to be a lot of one-size-fits-all policies that are going to correctly apply to every school district out there. I mean, in the state of Virginia where I live, we watched Lee County schools in the far southwestern part of the state. They decided we want to have school resource officers, but we can't afford them. So instead, we want to have armed school staff. And our Attorney General, Mark Herring, stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. The only thing that you can do is hire those school resource officers that your school district can't afford. We know you can't afford to fix the roof leaks in your buildings. You can't afford to build new buildings for the students. But the only way to protect them while they're at school is to hire somebody you can't afford to hire. I don't know about you. I think that's asinine. And if, again, this is the best thing that a district can do, or perhaps the only option that a district has to protect those kids while they're at school, yeah, they should absolutely be able to do so. All right, getting back to our top story, the city of Cincinnati suing the state of Ohio. By the way, not the first locality in Ohio to do this. Columbus, Ohio has done this. Heck, Cleveland, Ohio has done this in the past as well. But this is the latest go-round. City of Cincinnati suing the state of Ohio over the state's firearm preemption law. And to join us to talk about it from the Buckeye Firearms Association, Legal Eagle, Sean Maloney Esquire, is with us on the program. Sean, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Cam. How about yourself today?
I am good. I thank you very much for coming on the program. As I mentioned, Cincinnati, not the first locality to have a lawsuit underway, but these types of lawsuits, it seems like have been taking place in Ohio ever since firearm preemption was passed in Ohio.
Well, you know, you're right. Way back in 2010, OFCC versus Clyde. In fact, Ohio's preemption laws had went up to the Ohio Supreme Court on two separate occasions. And on both times, they've upheld preemption laws. Now, the House Bill 228 expanded who can sue under preemption and expanded the damage provisions of it also. And now, and that seems to be what they're taking offense to. But Cleveland and Columbus forever have screamed that that it gets in the way of their home rule. And home rule really doesn't exist when you're dealing with firearms laws because they're meant to be enforced uniformly throughout the state of Ohio.
Yeah, okay, so yeah, you're right. They're suing specifically because of this bill, H.R. 228, and as the city alleges, they say that this violates the separation of powers spelled out in the state constitution, that the state, quote, acted unconstitutionally and illegally by enacting a punitive firearms preemption law. So again, they've lost that fight about whether or not the state can pass a firearms preemption law to begin with, right? The state said, yeah, the state legislature, yeah, they can do this. So now the argument is, well, this is punitive. They should only be allowed to pass a law without teeth. They should only be able to allowed to pass a law that we can violate at any time and nothing bad happens to us. Is that really their argument?
You know what? It is really their argument. We beat Columbus and the city of Cincinnati for a bump stock and enhanced trigger ban, and we're still arguing now. They're going to spend another $20,000 in fighting attorney's fees. They lost. They lost on the face of lawsuit we filed. And our judge in a prior case had already chastised them for wasting taxpayers' dollars. And now they're doing it again. And instead of just coming to a settlement and paying their attorney's fees like they knew they would have to, because we warned them in a letter, they decided to fight that. So that's what they want. They don't like the fact that Columbus lost and has to pay attorney's fees. Cincinnati recently lost and has to pay our attorney's fees. And all of a sudden we've enhanced, and rightfully so, if a citizen or organization in the state of Ohio has to sue a city or a municipality in the state of Ohio for violating the state's constitution, there should be some punishment. And that's exactly what the attorney's fees and other costs are made for, to make sure, hey, pay attention to what you're doing and don't tread on the rights of your citizens in your state.
You know, this is part of a broader campaign, as we've talked about here, Sean. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, passing local gun control ordinances, hoping that they would get sued, hoping that they would challenge Pennsylvania's firearms preemption law. And their legal bills are being paid for by gun control groups. Des Moines, Iowa, the city council there is getting ready to pass some local ordinances in violation of the state's firearms preemption law. Gun control advocates hate firearms preemption laws because they want a bunch of these local ordinances, right? They want that patchwork quilt of laws. A, it's easier to keep those laws on the books because it's harder to challenge each and every one of those municipal ordinances. B, I think they like it because it also places the legal gun owner in greater legal jeopardy when they leave their home with their firearm, because now you have to try to figure out, you know, what laws apply in the dozens of towns that you might be traveling through from point A to point B.
That's exactly right. It's just another form of gun control and what they're trying to do. And interestingly enough, through our discovery in the city of Cincinnati and Columbus, we found out that they have been communicating with Bloomberg and every town in their organizations. And they've been talking to each other for our lawsuits. And there's no doubt in my mind that this is a coordinated effort with every town backing up some of the legal fees or maybe all of it when it's all said and done. But it's Bloomberg and every town. The usual suspects, again, are attacking our rights in the state of Ohio.
Sean Maloney with Buckeye Firearms Association. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program twice this week. In honor of you making two appearances, we're going to have an armed citizen story from Cincinnati, Ohio today. How does that sound?
Perfect. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Sean. Have a very good weekend. Let's get to today's hero of the day. I kind of teased this yesterday. I said that we had several stories just in a 24-hour period with a similar theme. A woman who had taken out an order of protection against somebody, that somebody decides to violate the order of protection, and instead of that piece of paper protecting the woman's legally owned firearm ended up helping to protect her and her children. So this story, again, from Cincinnati, Ohio. Authorities said that a woman will not be charged after shooting her ex-boyfriend who was trying to break into her home through a window. This was yesterday. You can see the air conditioner laying there on the ground as he ripped it out, apparently. It took place about 4:30 in the morning. Police said officers at the scene found Dante Ruff suffering from multiple gunshot wounds to his abdomen. He was taken to University Hospital. He is expected to live and will be facing some charges. Police, according to WLWT, said the woman had a protective order out against Ruff, who is her ex-boyfriend, had a concealed carry permit as well, although that's not needed to protect herself in your home. Her five children were upstairs at the time this guy tried to break into her house. Police said the woman and Ruff have a long, violent past. And I want you to listen to this quote from the prosecutor in Hamilton County, Ohio, where Cincinnati is located, Joseph Dieters. He said, quote, "Thank goodness she had a concealed carry permit and was able to protect herself and her five children. It is hard to imagine what might have happened to her or her children if she had not been able to protect herself and her family." Well, the prosecutor is right. It is just, I have to say, it's rare to hear a public official like that come out so wholeheartedly in support of the right to keep and bear arms. I can't tell you how many armed citizen stories I've seen where the local police spokesperson, you know, trying to be, I guess, politically correct and not be Second Amendment neutral, let's say, says something like, you know, "We're yes, she had her firearm, and yes, it turned out very well, and you know, we're glad that she's safe, but you know, just remember, there's always in that butt of, but maybe you actually shouldn't defend yourself with a firearm." Now, I'm really glad to hear the prosecuting attorney in this case say, "I'm glad she had a gun. I'm glad she was able to protect herself and her five children," because again, at the end of the day, that order of protection, it's not a suit of armor. It's a piece of paper. And this is one of the things that gun owners talk about all the time. Criminals will violate laws. They don't care. So they've been told by a court, stay away from this woman. Did Dante Ruff give a damn about what that piece of paper said? Nope. Does he care that his ex had a firearm and was a concealed carry holder? I bet he does. Got some time to think about it now as he recovers from the injuries suffered as he tried to break into her home. So she is today's hero of the day. Our good guy of the day, brought to you by our friends at Odor Crusher from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Catherine Ritchie has lived in the same home in Tulsa, Oklahoma for 58 years. Sepulpa, which is a suburb of Tulsa. 3 weeks ago, that changed, according to KAKE. She said she was in the bathroom getting ready for bed. And she turned around, and she saw that her bed was on fire. Now, Tulsa area has been dealing a lot more with water and flooding than fire recently, but this is what Catherine Ritchie had to deal with. There were four boys, those four right there, not a boy band, but young heroes between the ages of 14 and 17. They're all hanging out, nearby house. They went outside because they were going to walk up to a convenience store, and they noticed the smell. Right? Dylan Wick, who's 16, said it smelled kind of like burning rubber. And then we heard the house alarm go off. Catherine Ritchie, still inside her home, still trying to put out this fire, she gave up. She calls 911. She hit her emergency call button. And then she said, "The smoke was so bad I couldn't see to get out of my room." She said, "I felt along the wall and I went into the closet. Went into that door," she said, "trying to get out of the room. I finally did get to the door." So while she's trying to feel her way out of the house, these four young men try to break down doors to get inside. Nick Bird, who's 14, managed to get through the back door. He ran inside. He found Catherine Ritchie in the hallway, which was filled with smoke as well. Catherine Ritchie said, "This young boy was right there. He picked me up, and I said, 'I can walk.' And he said, 'We're getting out of here.'" So again, those four heroes in Sepulpa, Oklahoma, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing and save the life of Catherine Ritchie. We thank you for being some of the many good guys out there. You have a great weekend. We'll see you here Monday, 5:30 Eastern, for another edition of Cam and Company on NRA TV.